Welcome to Christchurch Manchester Sermon Podcast.
We are one church that meets in various locations across Greater Manchester.
For more information about who we are or where we meet,
please visit www.christchurchmanchester.com.
We're in Acts today. We've been in Acts for quite a long time. This is a series that on and off we've been doing for nearly a year now. And today I've got a bit of a challenge because we're going to do six chapters of Acts today. We're going to cover from chapter 21 right through to chapter 26. And the reason we're doing it is they work together as one bit of story. This is all about what happened to Paul in Jerusalem, and trying to split it up, you just kind of lose the flow, you'd lose the continuity of what's happening. And it made most sense to look at it together. But it is a lot. So here's what I'm hoping to achieve this morning. Mainly what I want to do is to tell you the story of what happened in these chapters. So I will be narrating, I'll be describing, I'll be trying to get you into the drama of what happened when Paul was in Jerusalem. Along the way, I'll read some of the key verses. Some bits of it will be more kind of summarized, narrated. And then at various points when things happen that caught my eye or that I found, oh, that's interesting, we'll pause, we'll stop, we'll reflect on those things as we go. So that's the plan. I hope that works for you and is okay. Now, to summarize what we've seen so far, through the last bunch of chapters of Acts, we've seen Paul, along with different colleagues who he's taken with him, go on three different missionary journeys. And I wonder if we can have the map up here on the screen. There should be a map of some of these. Oh, yeah? Okay, well. Okay, well, that is not ideal. Can we have Andy's map? Can we see if that's any good? Okay, I can work with this. This is basically... I think this is the same map, you know. Okay. So, Paul did three missionary journeys. Now, one of them, the first one, was through, it says Asia, that's modern-day Turkey. Then the second one, he went into where it says Macedonia, that's modern-day Greece. And in recent weeks, we have seen the third of those journeys. And the third one was the longest one in terms of distance, and that is what's marked on here. So this is Paul's journey. He started up here in Antioch. He went back through Turkey, went round Macedonia, and then made his way home. Most of his base during this time was a place called Ephesus. We've heard some of his adventures there, and he ended up in Ephesus for about 3 years. As his time in Ephesus was drawing to a close, he was starting to... Do you ever have that thing where you just get that stirring inside you for something new, for something a bit different? You feel like God's got a new adventure in store for you. Well, Paul was starting to get these rumblings. He was feeling, my time in Ephesus is close to a finish. And he had a plan for what he wanted to do next, which we see in chapter 19. So if we look at Acts 19 from verse 21... It says, after these things had been accomplished, Paul resolved in the spirit to go through Macedonia and Achaia, and then to go to Jerusalem. And he said, after that, I must also see Rome. So there he is in Ephesus, and his plan is, all these churches that I've started in Greece, in Macedonia, I want to go there, I want to support them, I want to encourage them, I want to see how they're doing. Then let's go back to Jerusalem. Let's touch base with James and like the base church in Jerusalem. But really what's stirring in my heart, the big end goal, is I want to go to Rome. Because there was this commission from Jesus, wasn't there? Be witnesses to the ends of the earth. And when you think about the ends of the earth and okay, the world empire, it was the Roman Empire at the time, and Rome was the central point of it. So if he's got this vision to see the gospel spread all over the world, then at some point it's going to need to reach Rome. So Rome is very much on his radar. So if you think about what's Paul's prayer list in terms of what he's going to do, it's Macedonia, Jerusalem, Rome. That's what he's got pinned to his fridge. That's the lock screen on his phone. Macedonia, Jerusalem, Rome. Macedonia, Jerusalem, Rome. And then We've heard about how stuff kicked off in Ephesus, there was a bit of trouble there, and he had to leave. So this was Paul's opportunity now to step into this vision that he's got. So he does what he said. He went to Macedonia, he did his tour, he encouraged the churches there, and then he starts coming back. And on his way back, he meets up with the Ephesian elders at Miletus. We heard about that last time. He reminded them of some things that they already knew. He imparted some other things to them. It was a really emotional time with them. And one of the things he said was this. This is Acts 20, verse 22. Now, as a captive to the Spirit, I'm on my way to Jerusalem. That was next on his list. Not knowing what will happen to me there, except that the Holy Spirit testifies to me in every city that imprisonment and persecutions are waiting for me. And then that chapter ends with them getting on the ship about to head to Jerusalem. That's the kind of background that leads us into where we're starting today. We pick up today in chapter 21. And so they're on the boat. It's fairly plain sailing across the Mediterranean. And they land, again, if we can have the map, because it will just illustrate what's going on. They land at a place called Tyre, which is here. And Tyre is about 100 miles north of Jerusalem. A few days' travel, by the way, they travel on those days. The boat had landed there. They need to put off some cargo, maybe change some of the crew there. And so Paul and his friends decide to get off the boat in Tyre, and they know there's a group of Christians there, so they say, let's find them. Let's meet up with them. Let's spend some time with the Christians in Tyre before we make our way to Jerusalem. So this is chapter 21, verse 4. It says, we looked up the disciples and stayed there for 7 days. Through the Spirit, they told Paul not to go to Jerusalem. Now, just pause on that. That's odd, right? That's weird. That's an unusual, unexpected thing. So Paul, he's got this vision from God, Macedonia, Jerusalem, Rome. He hits Tyre, he meets the Christians there, and through the Spirit they say, you know that Jerusalem bit of your plan? Skip it. Nah, don't bother with that. Just hold that thought. They said farewell to the group in Tyre, and then they got on another boat a bit further down the coast, to another place called Ptolemais. They spent one day in Ptolemais with another group of disciples, and then a bit further down, they went to Caesarea. And in Caesarea lived someone called Philip. And we met Philip way earlier in the series. So you might remember the story about where there was an Ethiopian guy in a chariot, and someone went to them and shared the gospel with them, and the person was baptized. Well, that was Philip. He was the one who did that, and he lived in Caesarea. And Philip's home was a bit of a base for prophetic ministry. So Philip had 4 daughters living at home with him, and all of them were gifted in prophecy. And so his house seemed to have become a bit of a go-to place for other people who were also prophetic. And while Paul is staying at Philip's house, a guy called Agabus, Agabus was a prophet, he turned up to visit. And Agabus, he has a prophetic word for Paul. So we're still in chapter 21, down to verse 11 now. This has been of Agabus. He came to us and he took Paul's belt. So he physically got his belt and then he bound his own hands and his own feet with the belt. So let's do that. Let's just visualize it. So this is like enactment prophecy. Got props and all that. So he has bound himself. And his point in this, he says, this is the Holy Spirit. And this is what the Jews in Jerusalem will do to the man who owns this belt. They'll hand him over to the Gentiles, they'll bind him up, and they will arrest him. And then he says, when we heard this, the people urged him not to go to Jerusalem. Again, this seems strange. Let me take this off. I can't preach with my feet together for the whole time. But do you see what's happening? Paul has had this word from God that he's so convinced is the guidance of the Spirit. You've got to go to Jerusalem. He's built years on it. And now, twice within a few days, different people have told him, I think the Spirit's saying, don't go to Jerusalem. The first was a group of believers. Now you've got this person who's got a recognized prophetic gift. And then everyone starts piling on. It says, we all told him not to go to Jerusalem. Even his own travel companions are saying, you should bin that plan, Paul. Do something different instead. What do you think you should do? What do you think the right response for Paul in this moment would be? Because if he doesn't go to Jerusalem, if he decides to stay put in Caesarea or to just go directly to Rome, then he's going against his own conscience. If he's sure that the Spirit's been telling him, oh, you've got to go to Jerusalem, and he doesn't do it, then isn't he disobeying the leading of God? He's convinced that God is calling him to do it. And so it says he answered them, what are you doing, weeping, breaking my heart? I'm ready not only to be bound, but also to die in Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus. However, on the other hand, if he says, you know what, I'm going to go. I'm going to go to Jerusalem anyway. Well, isn't that kind of just being a bit hot-headed? Isn't that disregarding the Spirit-given wisdom of other people? Isn't that sort of despising the prophetic gift that Agabus and this group of disciples has? He's in a real pickle here. And this is the first kind of like reflection point I want to draw out of the story and just have us think about. And it's this. Sometimes being guided by God can be unclear and confusing. It can. I don't know if you've experienced this at times, that you've been looking to God to guide you, and it feels like you're hearing from him, but you've no idea how to make sense of what he's saying. It can feel conflicted. It can feel confusing. We love those moments, don't we, when God speaks really clearly and it's really obvious what he's saying. We love it when we can give testimonies like that. I remember when I was mulling over, should I move up to Manchester? I was seeking God's guidance on it, and I thought, I'll come, I'll spend a day, I'll visit Manchester, and I'll just see if God says anything. And I remember getting off the train, and I prayed as I got off the train, God, if you want me to move up here, I want you to give me a sign today. And later that day, I was walking down a back street on my own, and there was someone walking towards me the other way, and he was muttering and sort of chattering to himself, and I don't really know kind of what his world was. But when he got to me, he stopped and he said, this is a sign from God. I was like, what? That was amazing, right? Because I'd said, God, give me a sign. And you don't get clearer than that. And so for me, that was totally unambiguous. Okay, God has spoken. I know that he's asking me to move up here. I love telling that story. Partly because it's rare. Nothing like that has happened to me before or since. But sometimes we get these really clear moments of guidance from God. And if someone asks me, could you pray for me? Because I've got this decision I need to make. I've got this thing that I'm trying to figure out what to do with. Often the way I will pray is like that. God, I want you to speak to the person. Speak clearly. Speak in a way that there is no doubt. And do it soon. I often pray, God, speak this week. That's the kind of thing I like to pray, because we love it when the voice of God is so crystal clear. It's not always that cut and dry. I can think of another time when I was in the youth ministry world, and I was looking for a new job, and I had two job offers on the table. I could take a job in one place, or I could take a job in another place. On paper, both of them look good. There wasn't anything that made me sway one way or the other. So I was praying, God, show me what you've got for me. And to be honest, some days it felt really clear, like the Spirit was directing me, go for that one. And then another day, I'd be like, I think the Spirit might actually be saying, go for that one. And I'd pray, and there'd be different things and different words that other people would bring to me about it. And I just couldn't get any clarity. It seemed like it was a bit of both. And I couldn't quite discern. Another time, I'd taken on a kind of ministry initiative that I was doing. And I was excited about it. And I felt God was in it. And there'd been loads happening that was encouraging me that this was what God had for me. And then like a few days into it, someone sat down and said, I think you're sensing God saying don't do this. I'm really not sensing that at all. That is not at all what God is saying to me right now. But it's like this person was hearing something totally different. And I don't want to dismiss or diminish that, because this person was trying to listen to the voice of the Spirit. I was trying to listen to the voice of the Spirit, but it seemed like we were hearing him say very different things. What do you do when that happens? It's more common than we sometimes talk about, that hearing the voice isn't as clear as we would like. What do we do? Well, a few thoughts. So first thing I think we can do when we look at this story of Paul and Jerusalem is we can be encouraged. Oh, maybe this isn't just me. Maybe it's not just a problem that I can't hear God very clearly. Because if it's happening to Paul, of all people, on this missionary journey, then maybe this is part of the normal experience of discerning the voice of God. It's not that something's out of whack with Tom. It's that sometimes listening to the Spirit can be challenging, can be confusing, can be unclear. And the second thing that we might reflect from this story is, can we drill down on what things God's actually said and what things we might be adding to it? So I heard someone once say, when there's a prophetic word given, you could think of three different parts of it. So part one is the revelation. So what actually is it that God has said here? Is it that there's a particular picture that's been given? Okay, what is the picture of? Or is it that a specific phrase or word has been given by God? Okay, what is the phrase or word? That's the revelation. Part two is the interpretation. So what's God actually trying to say by means of that picture or that word? Like, what do we actually take that as relevant for? And then part three is the application. What should we do as a result of that? Well, how do we put it into practice? And to break the three down, I found it really helpful, because sometimes God might speak all three. God might say, here's a picture, here's what it means, here's what you do. And you get that kind of direction. But sometimes you don't. Sometimes you might just get the revelation and the interpretation. So God said this, I think it means this. And then you join the dots and say, okay, fine. Well, because of that, I will do this. So in my example, what was said? Well, a person walked up to me and said, this is a sign from God, revelation. Interpretation is, okay, this is a response to my request for a sign as to should I move up to Manchester or not. Then the application was for me to say, oh, right, okay, I'm going to move to Manchester then. Here I am, the three different bits of it. Sometimes you might only get the revelation. Sometimes it might just be, God, show me a picture. I'm not quite sure what it means. I want to share it anyway. Maybe it will make sense to you. So it could be that God speaks any of them. To ask, what has God actually said? Well, in this moment, what was the revelation? The revelation was Agabus taking the belt, tying the hands and feet, and saying, the person who owns this belt, when they get to Jerusalem, this is what will happen. So revelation is belt tied around legs. Interpretation is, if you get to Jerusalem, you're going to end up in prison. Application? Well, that wasn't in Agabus's thing. That wasn't something that Agabus brought from God. He brought revelation. He brought interpretation, and then everyone jumped on it. He said, oh, okay, obvious application. Don't go to Jerusalem, mate. You'll end up in prison if you go to Jerusalem. But right from the start, Paul said, that's all right. That's fine. I know I'm going to go to prison. That's going to happen wherever I go. I know that's part of my calling. I know that's part of my ministry. It's not that Agabus prophesied wrong. He was correct. You go to Jerusalem, you end up in prison. But the application that all the group around him had took from it, therefore you shouldn't go, well, Paul wasn't sure that bit was right. He says, okay, I'll hear it. I'll receive this word. I will end up in prison in Jerusalem. But you know what? I think that's what God's calling me to do anyway. So prison it will be. And I think just the final thing to say on this is, when we're in those moments, all we can do is do our best to hear the different voices, to hear what other people are bringing, to discern, is there something of God in it? But ultimately, we're the ones who need to give account to God for what we do with our lives and what we do with what he's speaking to us. So whatever then in our conscience we're most convinced, well, this is what God's saying, this is what God's guiding me to do, then we need to step out and to do that thing. And that's what Paul does. So back to the story. He does go to Jerusalem. They do go on that journey. When they get there, they're greeted by James and all the disciples who are there. And Paul arrives with stories to tell of all the amazing things God's been doing in Greece and Turkey and the Gentile world. But he finds that when he gets there, there are some other stories that have also made their way to Jerusalem. Paul's got a bit of a reputation preceding him. And it says in verse 21, "They've been told about you, that you teach all the Jews living among the Gentiles to forsake Moses. You tell them not to circumcise their children or observe the customs." So for the Jewish believers and the Jewish non-believers in Jerusalem, this is a really offensive thing that they've heard. Now, it's not strictly true. Paul hasn't been going around saying, "Oh no, don't circumcise your children, don't bother with the law." What he's been saying is, don't make your salvation depend on that. Don't make it out that that's the way that you get right with God. And definitely don't go making the non-Jewish people do that. Don't go imposing it on the Gentiles. But as a cultural practice, as a way of being as a people, he'd not spoken against it. But the reputation was that he had. Now, James had a plan for Paul. He said, "Look, we can remedy the situation. We can make things okay. Here's what I need you to do, Paul. Go to the temple. You need to do a purification ritual. I'll send some people in with you. And just let people see that you're actually okay with the temple. You're actually okay with the law, that you don't have an in principle problem with it." Now, Paul was okay with this. What Paul had been doing is wherever he'd been going, he'd been trying to build life the same way as the people there, because he wanted to reach them with the gospel. So in Jerusalem, going to the temple and doing this was fine with him. He explains it in 1 Corinthians. He says, "Well, to the Jews, I became as a Jew in order to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became as one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law, I became as one outside the law, though I'm not free from God's law, but under Christ's law, so that I might win those outside the law. I've become all things to all people, that I might by all means save some." This is contextualization. It's to the extent where it wouldn't compromise the gospel or compromise your conscience, it's adapting to the preferences and the ways of life of those around us to create maximum opportunity to win us for the gospel. So this was the plan. Paul was to go into the temple and do the ritual. The plan doesn't work. The ritual was meant to last 7 days. He's getting towards the end of it, and a group of other Jews who were not believers, they've heard the same rumours. They see him in the temple. Everything kicks off. They cause trouble. They drag him out of the temple. They beat him up. They try to kill him. And the Roman tribune, who was in charge of the army in the city, he heard about it. He broke up the violence, and then he took Paul under arrest. And he's just seen, there's this guy, he seems to be the centre of the trouble. I don't really know who he is. I want to get to the bottom of it. I'm going to arrest him. I'm going to ask him some questions. I'm going to try and hear his story. And so what Paul does when he's asked these questions is he tells the tribune his testimony. He tells him the story of how Jesus had met with him on the road to Damascus, how Jesus had turned his life around and then commissioned him to do what he's doing. His go-to response is sharing his story. And later in the passage, he'll do it again when he's questioned by somebody else. This is something we can all do. Each of us in this room has a story to tell of how God's worked in our lives and turned things upside down. I did it earlier. I told you a story from my life about when God spoke to me about coming to Manchester. It wasn't difficult, it didn't feel out of place or weird. It's a bit that lifted heads in the room and drew in interest of different people. It's sharing something of ourselves. And I found when I'm chatting with people, telling my story sometimes gets past the defences in a way where if I just gave them some theology about Jesus, they'd shut down. But if I say, "Hey, look, let me tell you what happened to me," people want to listen. People ask questions. For me, I find, because of the job I have, there's a really easy way in. Because people ask, "Hey, what do you do for a living?" "Well, I work for a church." And the response I most commonly get is, "Oh, you work for a church?" I'm pretty sceptical about faith or about Christianity. And so I said, well, you know what, that's funny, because I used to be pretty sceptical about it too. When I was 19, I would have said exactly the same. And the question I almost always get back is, oh, so what changed? Right, I've got a story to tell about what changed. I can share my story. You don't only have one story. The story about how you first met with Jesus is a brilliant one. But there are stories that are happening day by day as you're walking with Jesus, as he's doing things in your life. We all have stories to tell. And so Paul tells his story here. Now, when the Jewish crowd hear him tell his story, they get even more mad. And so the tribune wants to flog him, wants to say, I need to get every answer out of him. Shall I just beat him and flog him? And then Paul just casually drops in, like, so it's legal now, is it, to beat a Roman citizen who's done nothing wrong? And the tribune's like nervously, oh, I didn't know he was a nervous citizen. I probably shouldn't be doing this. And feels a bit tense about it. So he's trying to pass the buck. He's trying to get responsibility off his shoulders. And through most of these chapters then, we get a whole bunch of different hearings that Paul has before different people. So the first one's before the Jewish council. This one starts pretty tense because as Paul's giving his defence, the high priest slaps him in the mouth. And Paul knows he's in a room that's against him. So he plays the crowd a bit because he's aware of the dynamics on the council. And he knows there's some subtle theological disputes going on, particularly around the resurrection of the dead. Is that something we should look to happen? He's like, you know what this issue all boils down to? It all boils down to my belief in the resurrection of the dead. And he starts like turning the room against each other and getting them into this debate that they've been having. So the whole thing just kicks off, it gets too heated, and the tribune's concerned that this meeting's broke down. So he gets Paul back out of it, brings him back to the barracks. Now, some of this group on the council, they want to kill him. They're plotting against him. They've had enough of Paul. So they come up with this plan to murder him. Paul's nephew overhears it. I don't know if he was like hiding behind a door when they were talking or what, but we know that Paul's nephew finds out about it. He sneaks a message to Paul saying, there's a group here, they've got a plan, they want to kill you. And so what Paul does is he then gets a message to the tribune. So this Roman guy who's overseeing the whole process. I find this interesting. This is just a little aside, but just think about what's going on here. You've got a person who's in imminent harm, Paul, and what's his response? His response is to contact the secular authorities who could do something about it, the Roman tribune. Just worth saying, there's biblical precedent for responding in that way. And when we encounter those situations for ourselves or for others, we should not be suspicious about involving whatever authorities can be involved to prevent harm. That's exactly what Paul is doing here, and we're seeing it in the Bible. So the tribune wants to pass the buck again, so now he elevates it up to the governor. The governor is a guy called Felix, and he's based in Caesarea. So he gets the Jewish leaders in, he gets Paul in, the Jewish leaders make their case, Paul makes his defence, and being a good politician, Felix doesn't come down on one side or the other. He chooses a halfway option. And his halfway option is, let's keep him in custody, but let's give him some liberty. Let's not stop his friends coming to see him. Let's not stop his friends taking care of him. He's basically under house arrest in Caesarea. And what we're told Felix wanted was for Paul to turn up with a big bag of cash and say, here you go, Felix, here's a big bribe, now you can let me go. This didn't happen. So Paul is in Caesarea for the next 2 years under house arrest. Felix eventually moves on from the job and is replaced by a guy called Festus. Festus comes into post and he's like, hang on, who's this guy Paul? What's going on? Why is this case still unresolved after 2 years? I want to get this thing dealt with. He calls Paul to him and says, Paul, you've got a choice. You're going to have a trial and you can pick. Do you want to go to Jerusalem and have a trial by the Jewish council? Paul's thinking, I don't want that because I know they want to kill me. That would be a bad plan. So he says, okay, your other option is you can have a trial here with me in Caesarea. And Paul's thinking, that's not quite a plan that I want either, because I've been here for 2 years. Nothing's got resolved. It's probably better than Jerusalem. Paul comes up with option number three, and he says, actually, I appeal to the emperor. So as a Roman citizen, you had certain rights. One of your rights was if you had a trial and you were unhappy with how it was being handled, you could appeal to the emperor, and then your case would be heard by, theoretically, by the emperor himself. Normally, it would be the emperor's appointed magistrate in Rome who it was delegated to, but you would go and be in the emperor's court. And so that's what Paul does. This is Acts 25, verses 10 to 11. Paul said, I'm appealing to the emperor's tribunal. This is where I should be tried. I've done no wrong to the Jews, as you very well know. Now, if I'm wrong and have committed something for which I deserve to die, I'm not trying to avoid death. If there's nothing to the charges against me, no one can turn me over to them. I appeal to the emperor. So Festus says, great. You've appealed to the emperor, it's to the emperor you're going to go. So he's going to have a trial now before the emperor. Then Festus, he goes to see the king of the region, that's Agrippa. And basically his problem is, Paul's appealed to the emperor, I've got to send him to the emperor. I don't really know what the charges against him are. So I'm sending this guy to the emperor to be tried. And I can't even tell him what he's done wrong. That's a bit weird. That's going to look bad on me, isn't it? That I'm sending him this way. So Agrippa then calls Paul before him, questions him. Paul tells his testimony again, and it ends with Agrippa saying, are you trying to turn me into a Christian? And Paul says, yes, that's exactly what I'm trying to do. I'm praying for you, Agrippa. I want you to become a Christian. As they're leaving then, Agrippa and Festus have a conversation. Acts 26, verse 31. As they were leaving, they said to one another, this man is doing nothing to deserve death or imprisonment. And Agrippa said to Festus, this man could have been set free if he'd not appealed to the emperor. So they reckon, oh, he's innocent. So if he'd have had his trial there, that would have worked out pretty well for him because they'd have ruled in his favour. But he's appealed to the emperor. So that's what's going to happen. And now he's got to go to Rome to face trial. Do you remember what the Holy Spirit laid on Paul's heart when he was in Ephesus? Go to Macedonia, did that. Go to Jerusalem. Well, he did that and then spent the whole time there in prison. And then go to Rome, probably not in the fashion he envisioned it happening, but he will be going to Rome to stand trial in the emperor's court. But God had spoken, Macedonia, Jerusalem, Rome. And where's Paul going? Macedonia, Jerusalem, and Rome. And there's six chapters of the book of Acts. It's an interesting story. It's one we don't talk about very often, isn't it? And we don't get into some of this stuff. I don't know where this story lands for you. I don't know what things are sparking off in your mind and your spirit as you're hearing it. Perhaps for some of you, it's the bit about how he shared his testimony, how telling the story was his go-to. Perhaps for some of you, it's just that reminder to drop those stories into conversations with others. Perhaps some of you know you've got a story to tell. Tell your story to the room. Encourage us with what God has been doing. Maybe some of you just see the whole sense of how he faced hardship and opposition and people going at him for his faith. And you just identify with that at the moment. We'd love to pray with you if that's the case. We'd love to stand with you in whatever you're going through. Maybe you're confused about what God's saying, about the guidance that he's doing. Maybe you've got decisions coming up in life. Or maybe it's the opposite. Maybe you're really crystal clear. You've got your version of Macedonia, Jerusalem, Rome. You know what the Spirit is telling you, and you're excited and you're ready to go. God meets all of us in different ways. Scripture's so rich, full of amazing truths.
Thanks for listening.
To explore this sermon or learn more about our church, please navigate to the links provided in this podcast description.
From there, you can connect with us on social media, and you're welcome to check out the music links featured in this episode from our very own musicians.
You can also discover current events and information about where we meet on Sundays and various groups or community projects that you can join in with.
If you're interested in knowing more about us or wish to join us for one of our meetings, please reach out.
Simply drop us an email at hello@ccm.org.uk.
We look forward to connecting with you.